You're listening to a podcast of spurious morality.
Hello and welcome to a podcast of Spurious Morality. I'm Johnston and with me this week I have Gareth. Hello, Gareth.
Hello.
And we're doing a trilogies episode. We've not done one of these for quite a while. I think last time we did one we had Joe Lidster on with us and it ended up being a bit of an epic. So sadly, just to manage expectations, no Joe Lidster this time, but you have got us two. And the plan is to discuss the Stockbridge trilogy, which was, I think, quite an early one. It wasn't the first Fifth Doctor trilogy, because that was Key to Time, but I suspect it was probably the second. And it's a good one. It's quite nice. You know, the Doctor has three adventures in Stockbridge across different times. You've kind of got one past, one present, one future. And it's... it's great because it kind of tells the story of the village across different times. It's somewhere the Doctor's visited an awful lot in books, and I think it originated in comics. So it was kind of good to have an extended, sort of extended run there on audio. So let's start with a question. What was your favourite of the three?
It's one of the first two. I have actually listened to them twice now, just to kind of really try and top up my brain as much as I could. But yeah, I think they've Castle of Fear and Eternal Summer have both got very different kind of strengths. I feel like Castle of Fear might be more fun, but yeah. In my brain, I feel like maybe Eternal Summer is technically better. It's a tough one. I think if I had to just pick one to listen to, it's probably going to be Castle of Fear.
Yeah, I get that. It's it's definitely fun. It's for the most part, a silly story. It's actually quite bloodthirsty. We've got a few sort of unpleasant things going on and, you know, a few character deaths and that kind of thing. But yeah, at its heart, it's a bit daft. It's a bit of a farce. And it's very, very enjoyable. I think I'd have to pick Eternal Summer though. It just does something a little bit weird and a little bit different, and it's kind of I like the fact that they brought the character of Maxwell Edison into audio. I think he's another comic character, a comic thing. Mm. He's been brought into audio, played by Mark Williams, who's just fantastic. And it's a thoroughly good adventure. We get Evil Doctor and Nyssa, which is a lot of fun. And yeah, I like what this one does. It just sort of hits the right notes. I think it's fair to say that it's a good trilogy. Like it's pretty strong all the way through. I know that quite a few people will sort of agree with what we've said, that the first two are the better stories in there, but Plague of the Daleks does have quite a bit to offer, which we shall explore soon, I guess, within the next 40 minutes or so. As a trilogy, let's just talk about it as a trilogy before we dive in on the individual stories. Do you like what this one does? Because I don't think there's really any other trilogy like this. We've had trilogies that are focused on characters, or we've had trilogies that have been part of a wider storyline. We've had trilogies that have told a story across three releases, but I don't think we've ever quite had anything that's sort of, or anything else that's kind of pinned down to a place. So do you kind of like how this one works and how it connects together?
Well, I do agree it's quite different. So when you say to me Big Finish trilogies, I tend to think of more kind of plot trilogies. So like we're going to build up to something and have a payoff. So my immediate thought is going to be something like the first Klein trilogy, where you've got a really clear direction. They really knew how they wanted that to finish up. This one is a little more kind of loosey-goosey. It sort of reminds me a bit of the early New Adventures when they do a story arc, which they kind of stopped doing pretty quickly. They were very loose. So they were saying to the authors, okay, here's the idea, but just go off and write some novels and we'll figure it out. And in this, it's three kind of versions of this place, but it doesn't feel like they're trying to sort of particularly build a story. They're saying to the authors, just go off and do whatever. I mean, as you say, they have got this past, present, future thing baked in. So there is a structure to this, but yeah, it's not really a plot thing. I would say there is at least one example of a place one, and that's Excellus, which I think might be the first Big Finish trilogy, where again you've just got a place, and the story kind of goes away, comes back, goes away, comes back again. In that case, it was different doctors though, so that it didn't feel quite as contained as this one. Here you've got, obviously, it's all essentially one linked story. It's a bit like season 12 of the classic series, when you know, they leave the Ark in space and then they're sort of mucking about with time rings all the way through to Revenge of the Cybermen, basically. It's a little bit like that. Yeah, I like this approach. I think I probably would get more excited about something that was more kind of plot, where you think this third story is going to pay something off, maybe. But in another sense, it's nice to kind of remove those particular stakes so you can more just like enjoy three stories and just go, well, all right, what are these authors going to do, and is any of it particularly going to complement each other? And I think some of it, deliberately or otherwise, does. You know, these stories do feel like they have a few similar interests. But yeah, it's an interesting approach. I like it.
I guess when they did this, they were still trying to work out exactly what they were going to do with these trilogies, because, you know, we'd had the monthly range for over 100 releases. There's a trilogy or two in there. We have the Villains trilogy, which we've discussed in the past. They kind of retroactively turned The Harvest, The Gathering and The Reaping into a trilogy. I'm just trying to think of any others. I know that some were recorded in trilogies but released not in all, you know, not in a row.
Well, you've got your sort of Project Twilight kind of thing.
Although, yeah,
that might have been a two.
Yeah. So it's, but they did kind of shift to release the monthly range, the main range as trilogies. And early on, they did try to do something with those trilogies. Like I say, you know, there was the Key to Time, which had a very obvious sort of story running through it. And there was, you've mentioned the Klein trilogy. There was another one as well. Oh, the Sixth Doctor and Jamie.
Sixie and Jamie. Yeah, there it is.
Sixie and Jamie, yeah. And it's, they were obviously sort of playing with the idea of, well, you know, how are we going to do this? Are we just going to release three stories in a row? Are these stories going to connect? And some of, I mean, the Sixth Doctor and Jamie trilogy, there's an argument that it's a 12-parter. It's just one 12-part story, split across three releases almost. Whereas this is, each story links to each other. We, you know, we do have that sort of connecting cliffhanger at the end of each story. It's very 60s. It's very early 60s Doctor Who, very season one, season two. But it's each story is sort of very different. It is its own story. You've got little elements carried over, sort of the Rutan spaceship from Castle of Fear being buried under Stockbridge kind of has an impact as the series, the trilogy moves on. But it's each story does have its own identity and its own feel as well, I think. As we pointed out, Castle of Fear is nothing like Eternal Summer or Plague of the Daleks. Let's zoom in on each story then. So Castle of Fear is the first one. As we've said, it's a fun story. It's a little bit silly. It has some good jokes. I'm a big fan of the whole, what, Maud the Strumpet? No, Maud the Withered, which seems to be a running theme up until Maud the Withered is horribly murdered. Its tone is kind of a little bit all over the place, but not in a bad way. Its tone's all over the place in the same way that the tone of The Romans is all over the place. You know, it's a comedy, but actually there's some pretty nasty stuff going on. It's a Rutan story. I think this is the first appearance of the Rutans at Big Finish. I've said that and I've automatically realised I'm wrong. It's not. Bernice Summerfield did them first, didn't she? It's the first Doctor Who Rutan appearance at Big Finish that I can think of. And I think the Rutans used quite well. It's kind of disconnected from everything else that's going on in the story. It's almost like the Rutan is the B plot, really. The sort of whoever rules the village and all that kind of thing seems to be the main story. But it's a nice little timey-wimey one. We kind of told the story at the start through the mummers play that the Doctor and Nyssa go to see. And then they very quickly realise the play is about events that involve them. And then they end up going back in time and getting stuck into these events. And it kind of plays out as the play at the start suggested. It's not doing anything big or clever. We don't have any big kind of predeterminism plot going on. It's not like the Doctor dies at the end of the play or anything like that. It's more just a little bit of a something to get the story going and, you know, can we figure out what everything's meant to be? So what are your thoughts on this one, Gareth? What do you think of Castle of Fear?
So I do think it's got some relatively clever ideas in it. I really like the sort of finding out that they are part of history. Because, like you say, normally it's in the new series, it would be more kind of grandiose. It would be, oh, the Doctor dies or something. Here, it's almost an annoyance, really, to kind of go, oh, we're obviously going to have to get involved in this ridiculous story that's irritating us both, you know, this whole mummers thing. And the first episode, I think, makes some interesting choices with that, where it has the sort of present day plot, which I think is like the end of the 19th century or something, but has the Doctor and Nyssa kind of bumbling about and figuring out something isn't right. And it also cuts back to the medieval time before the Doctor and Nyssa even get there. So it's kind of doing some interesting stuff there right at the start. It's definitely more comedic than I think is usual for sort of telly Doctor Who, but I think, you know, good comedy is always worth a try. I think if something's funny, then it's a bit better than something that isn't. The comedy is quite broad, but I'm sort of here for that, really. In this case, I think it works. It's sort of pitched like The Blackadder, the first series, shades of kind of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, or even Maid Marian and Her Merry Men. I mean, it's all a bit kind of laughing at the peasants kind of thing. And the peasants being sort of really pleased about being serfs rather than peasants or vice versa. There's loads of jokes dotted around, and you can tell Alan Barnes has just had a lot of fun kind of working those in, because sometimes he doesn't even really draw attention to them or even kind of finish them necessarily. So there's one joke where they're talking about being branded for things, and they say that they accuse the man of rustling. So they go, right, so it's the Russell brand. Which is just an odd little thing that makes you giggle. There's a bit where one character is reciting the fact that someone was branded in such a way that it spelled out the word twit on them, but they don't finish it. It's just left hanging. So it's stuff like that where you can tell he's just kind of having a ball and being a bit daft. I think Peter Davison and Sarah Sutton, as much as you can tell anything like this from an audio story, I think they're having a good time. I mean, I think all three stories, they sort of lean more into the kind of idiosyncrasies of their performance that have come out over the years, as opposed to what's in the telly version. So I think this, the Doctor in this particular release, is kind of crotchety in a way that I think really suits Peter Davison now. Maybe doesn't 100% represent him in like season 20, but I kind of don't care because I just enjoy his performance so much. And similarly, I think Sarah Sutton, it sounds like I'm criticizing her, really not, but I don't think she sounds particularly like her season 20 self here. I think she sounds a little more older and wiser, but I think that really works for the story because she's hanging around with all these peasants and you suddenly go, oh yeah, Nyssa has this kind of regal bearing because of where she's from. And that kind of instantly works in the setting of medieval England when she's got to win over these people. So I really love those two in this. I think the guest cast is very good. I mean, I can't remember his name, but the Earl of Mummerset, who we find out is an imposter, I really enjoy his performance. John Sessions is in it doing some outrageous accents. And there's someone, Susan Brown, who was actually in all three releases to kind of offer us a bit of continuity about Stockbridge. She's in this as Maud the Withered, and she has just the most fantastic cackle. Like, I really enjoyed every time her character is just very amused by something that brought me a lot of joy. So I'm glad she's in all three releases. I'm glad it's a Rutan story. I think the plot is quite well worked out for them, and I really like the fact that it's a story with false identities baked into it. So you've got the Earl of Mummerset, you've got John Sessions' character, both of them are faking it, they're pretending to be someone they're not, and I think that's an amusing parallel when you've got literal kind of duplicate characters like the Rutans. I think it's a little bit strange that those reveals don't come until after the Rutans have been revealed. I think that's maybe a bit of a shame. Would have been nice to kind of bed in the idea of not duplicates, but like fakes ahead of time. But, you know, that's fine. I enjoy there's a little bit of misdirection later on when the Doctor thinks that Nyssa's been killed and Nyssa's just actually just completely saving the day all on her own, which is a great example of that character really coming into her own. She just uses her smarts and completely wrong foots the Rutans. And then at the end of the story, we it has to be said quite quickly set up the next story, but you know, that would have been a note given to Alan Barnes to kind of hurry up and get this done. But I quite enjoyed that because they do set up the concept that something is a bit wrong with the quote-unquote present-day setting story, where people are kind of reciting this dialogue from the past, and that turns out to be because they are descended from Rutan clones, and they've got this weird genealogy going on that's kind of like race memory or something. So they have to rush to the present and escape in this spaceship to kind of diffuse that situation. So it can be quite manic at times. But I do agree that the tone is a little bit scattered, because you have got on the one hand the kind of, you know, just laughing at peasants because they've got lots of boils or something. And on the other hand, you've got people getting murdered and stuff. But then you've also got people laughing about the fact that people have been murdered because this is just normal to them. So it's a strange kind of tone for a story, but I quite enjoyed the lightness of it, and I thought as a Rutan plot goes, this is pretty solid, I thought. And yeah, it just sounds like Peter and Sarah are very much game for this, and you know, up for this. It's right up their alley, it sounds like. So yeah, I would recommend it.
Yeah, I think it's also a very good opening story for the trilogy. as well. Like, I don't think this would be as good if it was story number two or three. I think it's very much the perfect introduction to a Stockbridge trilogy. And it's, you know, the trilogy does get darker as it goes on. You know, the last story in particular is quite morbid. But it's kind of, this is quite a good beginning of the journey. There are plenty of threats, but we're having a laugh while we're doing it. And, you know, there is, like you say, some great stuff with Nyssa and peasants, or are they serfs? You know, I'd rather be a peasant than a serf. Some great jokes there as well. And it's just a fun trilogy opener. It kind of sets you up for what's going to happen going forward, but what happens going forward isn't as light. So story number two is The Eternal Summer, which is the sort of weird timey-wimey one, I guess. And it's not a complicated story, but when you try to describe it, it sort of comes across as one. But the gist of it is basically time's going wrong in Stockbridge, and there are reasons for that. Again, this has got some good humorous moments in it. You know, Maxwell Edison's a great character, I've already mentioned, who, like I say, I believe comes across from the comics. I'm not familiar with Stockbridge comics, but we've got a character played by a great actor, Mark Williams, in his pre-Rory's Dad days. And it's, he does it well. He plays the character really, really well. And it doesn't take long for Nyssa to kind of be swept off. And Maxwell kind of becomes the Doctor's companion for the story. And actually, we kind of end up with something that's a little bit Nyssa-light as a result. Like, Nyssa gets swept off at the end of part one. She's hardly in part two. I don't think she gets reunited with the Doctor until the final episode. So it's kind of the Doctor and Maxwell, while Nyssa does stuff with Pig, the psychic investigation group. Brilliant name. We do get sort of a evil, ancient, vampiric version of Nyssa and the Doctor that are feeding off all the time going wrong stuff and initiating it. There's a tie back to the root and spaceship being the cause of a lot of the problems, or partial cause of a lot of the problems. It's good. It's a bit of a bit, well, quite a bit more serious than Castle of Fear, but it still does have its good moments. And, you know, it doesn't particularly have a happy ending for Maxwell. You know, it turns out that he's not dead, which is quite nice. But, you know, it sort of sets up this kind of wonderful relationship with another character. And unfortunately, it doesn't go anywhere, because in the real timeline, the woman is married, which is a bit of a barrier. It kind of resolves, well, it does resolve the cliffhanger from the end of Castle of Fear, but it also ends on a pretty similar cliffhanger, which is, oh no, it's all going wrong and we're being sucked into time again and all of this. So it kind of feels a bit odd, in a sense of it doesn't have the TARDIS, it just has essentially the same beginning and end, just for the sake of keeping the trilogy going. And at this point, I'd sort of say, could we just have had three visits to Stockbridge in the TARDIS? Did it all have to connect? Like, I like the fact that it connects. I've said I like the sort of serialized nature, season one and two style, but both Castle of Fear and Eternal Summer kind of end in the same way. And they end up being moved to a different time for near enough the same reason. You just sort of think maybe something else could have happened there, but just to give us a bit of end of story cliffhanger variety. But it's a minor niggle. So, Eternal Summer, go ahead, Gareth.
Well, it's definitely less kind of knockabout comedy than Castle of Fear. I do think it's quite lighthearted some of the time. I'd even say it's twee really. It's got a certain kind of village post office romance kind of vibe when it comes to Mark Williams and Pam Ferris, quite good casting as well as the head of Pig. So there are aspects to it that I think feel quite sort of sweet and charming. What it's saying about people's lives is quite, not bleak, but quite interesting and deep, really. The idea that people could relive their happy moments over and over again, but they have to relive all of the negative stuff as well. It's a very interesting concept. I think you could probably have dived into it a bit more if you didn't have to worry about the Stockbridge thing. So I think there is an argument that, you know, you could have had this story be its own thing. Because in the end of the story, the sort of denizens of Stockbridge finally realize that actually this is dreadful, and it's not worth constantly reliving stuff because they're sort of in a living death, really. So I felt like that maybe could have been more convincing if the story didn't have to worry about certain other things. But as a concept, I think that's really interesting. I really like Maxwell. I think it's important to say that I haven't read any of the stuff this comes from. I don't think you lose anything from that. You don't really need to. They're kind of being quite confident with their own continuity at this point, because Castle of Fear and this one have references to Andrew, who's a character who's in a one-part story in the release Circular Time. And that meant a huge amount to Nyssa. So I think that's just interesting that Big Finish is at a place where they can just drop in you heard that one part of a four-part release, right? And again, that doesn't harm it if you haven't heard it. But if you are familiar with it, that's quite nice. There's a bit in this story where Nyssa's memories are being kind of preyed upon. And those memories take the form of clips of Big Finish releases that she's been in. And that just makes sense. That's like, yeah, you've built this library, you might as well use that. So I kind of enjoy the attitude this story, and to a lesser extent the previous one, have to like continuity, where it can play with it, but you don't necessarily need to know it in depth. It has little meta touches now and again as well. You know, for instance, there's the way that Maxwell asks slightly annoying questions or makes slightly simplistic similes, like popping a balloon or something, which is quite an old sci-fi cliche, but then the Doctor kind of lampoons it by giving him another example that doesn't make any sense. And there are references to how ideas, someone will have given Pam Ferris's character some sort of idea for what's going on, and she says things like, oh, I think he just got it off the X-Files, or oh, I think he just got it off Buffy. So I think there's quite a knowing kind of aspect to the script of, and there's a reference to Groundhog Day as well. So that, you know, it's kind of lampshading it a bit, kind of going, yeah, we know you've heard stuff like this, but we're going to try and do it in an interesting way. And I think it does. You know, it's tremendously disorienting to not only have the characters reliving their lives, but also be aware of that, so that they're not powerless. You know, they can talk weirdly casually about the fact that their loved ones have died, and like, that's really sad, but oh well, they'll be back tomorrow. Sometimes they die in the wrong order, which doesn't make any sense, but they roll with it. So yeah, there's a tremendous amount of atmosphere here. I think that probably culminates in, as you say, the evil Doctor and Nyssa, which, where I was saying in the previous story that Peter and Sarah sound like they're having a good time, that was as nothing compared to the absolute banquet that is these two characters. I wish I could see footage of Sarah Sutton doing her kind of cackling crone, you know, when she's relishing the idea of eating people's memories, and she's like sort of smacking her lips and stuff. There's a bit at the end where the evil Doctor eats evil Nyssa, or, you know, her memories or whatever, but he's, you know, diving into it. So these performances, I was just giggling just listening to this. It's so much fun. It just feels like that's such a gift of a part to give these actors who are in these releases. And like, you know, a lot of these stories are going to be like quite similar to Doctor Who that they've done already, so anything you can do to kind of shake it up and make it weird, I think is worth trying. I like the way the story lands with Maxwell. It's quite sobering. As you say, he's kind of filling in for Nyssa. Maybe there's an argument that you could give Nyssa more of that kind of emotional outcome instead of a character we've never met before, and as it went on, presumably never met again. But, you know, if you just focus on what we did get, I think it works very well. I think really the only aspect of the story that, like I said, I heard it twice in the last couple of days, the only aspect that I kind of felt was a bit undercooked was Viridios, which is the mythical green man character who's sort of the totem of the forest and plant life. He is in some way responsible for what's happening here. So it's partly the Rutan ship. It's partly a sort of time crisis thing that's happened, but also there's this figure, Viridios, who is actually set up briefly in Castle of Fear. There's a reference to him, which you can sort of tell the script editor's hand in there, like, can you chuck this in there, please? And they sort of toy with the idea at the end of this, but I wasn't really convinced by what that was about or how much that had an effect. So I don't know. I wondered if that was something that was kind of presented to Johnny Morris to kind of go, can you have this kind of force? Because if you don't, then maybe the listener has to sort of more specifically reckon with the idea that the Doctor and Nyssa have become this monstrosity. And there's actually a bit where the Doctor says, like, there's absolutely no way that would just happen. It has to be something else. So maybe that was Johnny Morris. Maybe it was the editor. I don't know. But I felt like what they came up with pretty much was just kind of somebody with a voice distortion, and it didn't really mean anything to me. But, you know, that doesn't really matter overall. I think the story, its strengths kind of speak for itself. I think it's a very interesting take on a sort of time loop. And it's kind of a very melancholy way to treat like a little village story. So I think if you said to a bunch of writers, write your own Stockbridge story and just give us your most interesting takes, I think this is very, very obviously one that you would pick, because you'd go, yeah, that is a really interesting way to tell a story about a little village in a Doctor Who story that we haven't exactly seen before. So, yeah, I think with some caveats, it's pretty strong.
Yeah, I think it's one of those stories that doesn't do anything big or clever or different, but it does what it does. It handles some tropes that we've seen before and have seen again since just well. It's enjoyable. I mean, I enjoy this whole trilogy. I really do. Which is, you know, one reason I wanted to revisit it. I just thought, well, it's all three stories have something interesting to say about them. I think that Eternal Summer is probably the one that I have the most to say about. I have had the most to say about. It just gets it right. It's good. It's fun. Viridios, you're right, is a little bit sort of underdone. Maybe we could have explored that further. But if not exploring that further gave us more of Evil Doctor and Nyssa, kind of worth it, because it's very obvious, as you say, the two actors just having the time of their lives doing it. Let's shift on then. Let's shift on to Plague of the Daleks, the final story in the trilogy. And this, I find this one to be a bit of an oddity, because the Daleks turn up halfway through. The Daleks turn up at the end of part two, and everything that happens beforehand doesn't particularly have any bearing on what happens after. It's almost like, it's not quite, you know, there are links, obviously, but it's almost like two-parters set in this sort of futuristic museum version of Stockbridge, which I like the way of they've handled the kind of future story. Instead of just having Stockbridge in the future, it's actually Stockbridge as sort of being preserved as a museum piece, and everything's artificial, and it's kind of an interesting idea. You know, it's sort of saving a place for posterity. We kind of have a lot of characters doing a lot of things, and like I say, not an awful lot of it has has any bearing on the story. We do have quite a few latter half of part two, earlier part of part three deaths, and it's kind of, we're just going to brush some of these characters aside now because we've got a couple of parts with Daleks to do. The tone is certainly consistent. Like, it's not like we've got a very happy two parts and then a very miserable Daleky two parts at the end. It has got this sort of dark, morbid sort of sense of everything falling apart, going wrong, death type thing feel all the way through. And the Daleks obviously tie into that really, really well because they're that kind of bad guy. They're sort of closely associated with death. I like it. I think, well, we have both agreed it's maybe not as strong as the other two, whether it's because doing Stockbridge in the future is more of a challenge, throwing Daleks into it's more of a challenge, whatever it is, it doesn't quite click in the way the other two do. But I think there is an awful lot to enjoy here still. Nyssa and the Fifth Doctor as a sort of pairing, it's not a pairing we really see anymore. In fact, I think we only got one more trilogy with this pairing after this, which is the Moonflesh trilogy, or the trilogy that starts with Moonflesh at least. So this was kind of towards the end in terms of these characters, and they had quite a few Dalek stories, quite a few different Dalek stories. For some reason, Dalek stories got quite experimental with the Fifth Doctor and Nyssa. This is perhaps the least experimental, but I think it's possibly also the most interesting, despite the fact that Daleks aren't in it much and blah, blah, blah. And, it turns out that Daleks have essentially been in cryogenic stasis for a long, long time, and the Dalek Empire has kind of disappeared in that time, and this lot are just a bit old and knackered and left hanging on. They're still a threat. That's obviously made very, very clear very, very quickly. But the sort of structure of the story and the fact that it takes the Daleks so long to turn up, it does make it feel a little bit strange. But then again, I also don't know how I'd do this story if the Daleks rocked up 25 minutes earlier, so can't complain. It's bleak. It ends with the sort of out-and-out destruction of Stockbridge, and the Doctor realises that they've arrived at the end of Stockbridge. After all the timey-wimey stuff that's been going on in previous stories, this was kind of the last point in Stockbridge they could arrive at. It's quite a downbeat ending. We do get very moody Fifth Doctor, nice things end up being destroyed. And it sort of ends with them going, let's go somewhere happier. It's a bleak one. We've got another excellent guest cast. We've got Keith Barron. Who was Keith Barron Enlightenment, I think? Correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah. Yes.
He was a captain.
He was in Enlightenment. He also popped up in, was it the Bad Penny he was in? Tom Baker one, I think, A Big Finish. He puts in a cracking performance here. I like it. We've got Lisa Tarbuck, who plays a very sort of likeable character in Lisette, Remembered. and obviously Susan Brown's back again, as she is in every story in this trilogy. Again, it's a nice link. I do like it when they will sort of thread an actor through a trilogy. It just sort of gives, not a character continuity, but I guess like a thematic one. It kind of works with this, the idea of a village where not many people move to or from. It kind of fits. Go ahead, talk to us about Plague of the Daleks.
Well, I'm glad you said about Keith Barron and Lisa Tarbuck, because for some reason I just didn't check the cast list on this one, so I didn't realise either of them was in this. But yeah, they're both very good. Lisa Tarbuck, is she the one with the the elderly husband. He's sort of gravestone spotting. Because if she is, she's got this kind of weirdly orphan 55 habit of shouting out, "Oh, my Vincent, my Vincent." Or is that a different character?
No, that's a different one. So Lisa Talbot plays Lisette, who's kind of, she's the one that's in it all the way through and then sacrifices herself at the end.
Right, yeah. Getting my names mixed up. Well,
I have to admit, I did get Orphan 55 sort of vibes from the character you're talking about while I was listening to it as well.
Yeah, it's just interesting because it's kind of a mixture of sort of different Doctor Who-y tones. So at the start of it, you've got a kind of, I think, sort of android invasion thing where you sort of arrive somewhere and this little village is a bit odd and you can't quite figure out why. But obviously it's also a bit like The Eternal Summer because it's literally a question of what is the time period and they've just had this. So it's like, oh, is that what's going on here? And then when you have this tour group arrive, that all feels a bit Russell T. Davis to me in a good way, where it's, you know, these slightly silly people trying to have a nice time at the end of the world, basically, because we find out that sort of, what was it, 95% or something is uninhabitable by this point. There's loads of kind of funny little ideas, like these sort of killer crows for some reason that are around the place. There's the idea that people have been cloned successively just to create kind of like almost animatronic people that can interact with you because it's just easier than hiring proper people. So there's lots of stuff here that's interesting. And then you have the idea of this rain that's coming in and it's dangerous and poisonous. But I think it's one of those stories that doesn't quite come together. And I think one of the main reasons for this is pacing. So I think there's kind of an unwritten rule in Doctor Who that it's okay to call your story the one that's got Daleks in it and then not have them in it for an episode and have that be the cliffhanger. It's a little bit silly that you expect the audience to be surprised, but you know, if it was good enough for William Hartnell and John Pertwee and stuff, then fine. But it's two episodes with this, which I just feel is intrinsically kind of pushing it. Like you're sitting through episode two and everyone's like, "Oh, what's going on?" And you're like, "It's probably the Daleks and this rain is probably some form of plague, I reckon." It's an interesting choice to kind of defer it that far down the line. And there's even more deferment there because the Doctor doesn't find out about the Daleks until the end of part three, which I think is an error. I don't think that's a good thing to do with your story because it's like, right, if the Doctor doesn't even know there's a problem, then it feels to me like we sort of haven't started the stopwatch on the story. Like once the Doctor understands the stakes or even the threat, then that's when we've really kicked off. And if he doesn't know about it, then it's a little bit like, well, don't do anything too serious because you haven't gone and got him yet. And then once you have got him, you've then only got one episode. So it's like, to wrap it up, it kind of accidentally says, this is a 30-minute problem to resolve because that's the amount of time the Doctor needed to sort this out. So those, and I agree, I don't know what the better version of that is, how you reorganize this story. But I'm a bit surprised that they went that route. I think it slightly overbalances it. I still think there's good stuff here. I really like those characters who come in externally to kind of enjoy this tourist exhibit of Stockbridge. I really liked the professor. I can't remember his name, but he's basically gelatinous character. And I think you alluded to they sort of get got out of the way. I do feel that was the case. They sort of kill them off and then we kind of move on. So he was one of those characters where he got killed off so easily, and I kind of found myself thinking, well, he is made of jelly, so like, can you exterminate jelly? I don't know. I feel like maybe he'll be fine, but no, he wasn't. He's dead. So I thought it was interesting that it did build to a somewhat downbeat ending. Although, you know, if we're honest, I mean, the Earth is basically uninhabitable by this point. So like, the fact that there is any remnant of Stockbridge at all is weird. Like, it's nice, but that's not really Stockbridge anymore. I mean, it's not really serving the same function that it used to. So it's a sad ending that it's destroyed, but it's also kind of, I think, tempered by, well, you know, everybody moved out already. Yeah, it's fine. I mean, I like the idea. I think it's a kooky and silly, but in a good way, idea. That the Daleks would literally go, he seems to like this Stockbridge place. I reckon we go and lay a trap there. That's an unusually pragmatic choice by the Daleks to just go, right, we'll just go there, we'll wait, and eventually he'll turn up again. I'm surprised they didn't spot the TARDIS, which is presumably there. Kind of lost track of it, to be honest, across the three stories. But yeah, they just lie in wait, and they kind of wait too long, and then half of them don't work anymore. Yeah, and then we have the whole stuff with the poison rain and the sort of mind control. I think it's a story that has lots of ideas, and all of them individually are fine. Most of them are quite good, but I don't really get the sense of a very strong kind of unified story. And maybe that's completely unfair. Maybe that's just because the pacing of it is quite unusual. So I kind of struggled to get a handle on it. It's such a traditional Doctor Who story in many ways. Like I said, it's got those aspects and those kind of moods that kind of feel like eras of Doctor Who you recognize. But then as a story, like executed beat for beat, it's a bit weird and a little bit wobbly. So I kind of couldn't exactly get a handle on what was going on some of the time towards the end. But yeah, like I said, I still enjoyed it. I think I enjoy Mark Morris's writing. I mean, I mostly know him from his BBC Books novels. They're surprisingly gory compared to this. Yeah, I wonder if it's a degree of... It's kind of unfortunate that you don't have that plotty kind of trilogy that I alluded to earlier where you have a big conclusion that you've been building to. With this, they kind of manufacture one and they go, right, it's literally the end of Stockbridge. That's the reason we're going there. But apart from that, I don't know. I don't know if it's a story that really needed Daleks necessarily. Maybe it could have been something else, but obviously that's useful for sales. Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of rambling a bit now, but I mean, I liked it. I enjoyed it, but I think it's a little bit of a mess. And, it's just not as strong a kind of idea as either of the other two stories, which I think is why people probably tend to slightly leave it out of the conversation when they talk about the trilogy.
We didn't leave it out of the conversation, but we, neither of us have said it's a favourite. It's just got that strange kind of... it feels a bit messy. The structure's a bit odd, but I still find it enjoyable. And actually, I like the stuff before the Daleks turn up. It's not really got much to do with the Daleks at all, but it's quite good. It has got a bit of a Orphan 55 kind of feel about it, but I think I definitely prefer it to Orphan 55. Faint praise and all that. Anyway, that's the trilogy. Anyway, it's a good trilogy. I like this trilogy. It's, you know, we've not picked it because it's big and wild and exciting and world breaking. It's just a really nice, solid, early Big Finish trilogy, and it's been really nice to discuss it. So we will leave it there, but we'll do another trilogy sometime soon. We need to sort of pick one and go with it. Because I do like revisiting trilogies that I probably wouldn't normally automatically venture back to. Sort of a lot to discover there. But like I say, we'll leave it there for now. So thank you for joining me on listening to and discussing the Stockbridge trilogy, Gareth.
More than welcome. Thank you.
And we will be back for more spodcasting very soon. Goodbye now.